So this week and next week, what I want to do is right after the Meraglim story, we get a series of mitzvot in Perek Tet Vav, and then the sort of most well-known of the mitzvot that we get is at the end of the parsha is the mitzvah of tzitzit, is the third paragraph of Shema, which we'll focus on next week. But the question that I want to focus on, and this is something we've talked about a lot, we talked about in Vayikra, and it's even more striking in Bamidbar, which is what is the relationship between the laws that appear in Bamidbar and the narrative? Because, you know, in Bamidbar especially, at first glance, the laws seem to be just dropped down in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of stories. But when you look at it at second glance, it seems like they're actually contributing to our understanding of the story, or in some ways rectifying the problems of the story. So that's what I want to try to take up today. So Perek Tet Vav, after we've had the story of both the Meraglim and the Ma'apilim, right? Both the original story and the decree, and then the attempt to storm the land by force, and God saying, you're not going to win, you're not going to win, and they try, and they die. So then you get these mitzvot. So Perek Tet Vav starts off by Daber Adonai Moshe Lemor, Daber al Bnei Yisrael v'amarta lehem ki tavo el eretz moshvotechem asher ani noten lachem. So he tells the Jewish people, tell them that when you come to the land, which I'm giving to you, v'asite mishel Adonai ola ozevach lefalei neder uvindavah v'madechem lasot reach mechoach l'Adonai min habakar min atzon. So then you will make, you'll bring a karbanot, you'll bring fire offerings, right? You'll bring olot, right? Karbanot that are fully consumed, zevach, shlamim, karbanot that are partially eaten, to fulfill your vows, or on the holidays, to make a reyach nichalach, a pleasing aroma to God. V'kriv ha-makriv karbanot adonai min chatzolet yiseron balul b'revivit hayin shaman. And the one who brings it will bring a measure of flour, mixed with oil, and you'll have wine libations of a revit that you'll bring when you bring a karban. The amounts are different for whether you bring a sheep or a goat, and if you bring a ram, so then it's two esronim of flour with a third hin of oil, and then a third of a hin of wine, takriv reich nechach l'Hashem, v'chita seven bakar ola ozavach lefalei neder ushlamim l'Hashem, and when you bring a cow, v'kriv al ben bakar min chatzolot shloshasrim balul v'shem chatziyahin, v'yayin takriv l'nesach chatziyahin yishe reich nechach l'Adonai, and then you'll bring, right, so you bring more wine and more oil, kacha yaseh l'ashor ha'achad ola ayel ha'achad ola seh baksevim ova izim. That is what you'll do if you bring cows, or you bring rams, or you bring sheep, kamispar asher tasu, kacha tasu lechad kamisparam, and the more karbanot you bring, the more of these you bring, kol ezrach yaseh kacha reila akriv yishei reich nechoach l'Adonai, every citizen will do this, v'chi agur itchem ger, and then here he says, and the same thing will be true of a ger, the halacha is the same for everybody. So the first halacha you get is that when you bring karbanot, you have to bring along with them mincha, and you have to bring wine, and you have to bring oil. So, first question is, why does this mitzvah appear here? Right? Why? Right? It seems like, as we pointed out months ago, it seems like a Vayikra halacha. Right? It's a question of karbanot. Just put it in Vayikra. Why do you save it until Bamidbar? So, there are different directions the Mefarshim take. One possibility is that the halacha is really incidental, right? It's not about the halacha, it's about one line in this whole halacha, and that is the first line, which is ki tavo'u el haaretz, that when you come into the land, right? The choice of law is incidental, but the reason that there's these set of laws is because God had just told the Jewish people that they're going to die, and their children are going to go into Israel. Now, obviously, people are depressed and they're worried. Is this actually going to happen? Now, God could just say, he did just say, you will go into the land. But there's a difference between telling people, don't worry, you'll be there eventually, and giving them practical instructions, right? When you get there, the first thing I want you to do is, you know, bring a karban. When you bring a karban, these are the laws, right? It makes it real, right? It's like, you know, the beginning of the school year, right? Kids are accepted into a school, right? They're starting the new school year. They know it's not real yet, right? They've never been to school. They never started first grade. But when they get the letter for the first day, you need to bring three notebooks and you need to bring, right? You know, we'll be learning this Parsha, and we'll be learning this in math, and we'll be learning this in reading, and these are the supplies you need to bring, right? It's real. It's no longer theoretically, this is what I'm doing next year. It's, there will be a time, you know, September 3rd at 8:30, you have your first class, you'll be meeting your teacher, you'll be doing this. It becomes real. And the Jews who are afraid that they're not going to go into land, God just needed to tell them, don't worry, when I say this generation will die out, but eventually the Jews will get into Israel, I mean that. Like, this will happen, it's going to be real. And that's what Rashi basically tells you in number one. Ki tavo, what was the point of this? Biser lahem shechnasu la'aretz. He gave them tidings, right? He told them, you will go in, this is real. It will indeed happen. And that's why you have this law. And the next law, which we'll come to in a minute, is challah. Right? Challah also is predicated on being in Israel, right? Once you're in Israel, so then you have to separate challah from your flour. Now, we do it outside of Israel as well, but the biblical obligation of challah is in the land of Israel. So you get an agricultural law. Again, it's that very concrete instruction to the Jewish people. The Ramban takes this position, though slightly differently, and he gave it to you here in two, in the Torah Aruch, just because I could find translation of the Torah Aruch. So it's more of it's the Sfaria translation, which is a bit of a loose translation with a bit of elaboration, but it's fine. He says as follows, Kitavo la'aretz, Katav Ramban, Achar shiftiach habanim biviat ha'aretz, Hishlim Torah HaKorbanot, Vishlim od Torah HaKohanim. Right, once God had promised and assured the children that they would, at any rate, enter Israel, so he finished the laws of the Karbanot and Vitziva Lalachala Shalonag Benvar. He gave them laws that would not apply until they got to Israel. He wanted to make it real. The Rebbe Avraham Katav, Nismecha zot parsha ba'avur shenech leshuv v'nitablu l'nachem abanim l'odiyam ki yavou el ha'aretz. And the Ibn Ezra takes a slightly different formulation and says it's not just to the parents, right? It was to the children, right? It was the children were depressed because they were worried, right? You know, about them going into the land, right? They were worried what would happen. So it wasn't that he was talking to the parents, he was talking to the children who would in fact survive, right? This wasn't just a national promise, right? Israel as a people will come in. He was turning to the children saying, you will actually get there. Don't worry, it'll be 40 years because you have to be the adults to come in. The adults currently will not go, but you will. So he was comforting them. V'nachon ba'avur shenasu kol kalayidah v'chatu v'nislach lahem. But he takes this a little bit farther, and he said, and Ibn Ezra said, it's not just that. It's not just that he needed to comfort them, but the Jews had performed some level of tshuva, right? At some level had repented, and had been forgiven before Tfilat Moshe because of Moshe's promise. Right, kiddush guvago. Remember, Amar v'nislach lem v'huzkar lazkir mishpat min. Minchat kol olav v'zevach v'sof nevesher taseh b'yad ramah remez l'maaseihem. Right, so he wanted to hint to the fact that they were forgiven. So he talked about karbanot, right, which represent forgiveness. And as we'll see, the third law here is not just any old karban, but it's a karban for forgiveness of a national sin. So it was specifically karbanot that were chosen to tell them that they were forgiven. And then we'll get at the and then at the end we'll see that we're going to get the story of the Mikoshesh, of the person who's going to violate Shabbat, which we'll come back to in a minute. But what you see here is this notion that the laws are put here, right, at a broad level to convince them that it's real, you will go into the land. But not only that, some of the Mepharshim push it a little bit farther and say, no, it's actually giving them important indications that not only will go to Israel, but I'm going to talk about laws that relate to forgiveness. I'm going to talk about Karbanot. Now, Rashi and the Ibn Ezra and the Ramban take this as a comforting, right? As a comforting presentation, right? Don't worry, you will eventually go in, or the kids, don't worry, you'll get in. And Dabz Kanim in number 4 takes a slightly different variation on this, and he says, "Laman Yismecha Parsha Zula Parsha Meraglim Lefi Kishashamu Yisrael Gzeratosha Kodesh Baruch Hu Amru Oylanu Leolam Lo Nichnas Lanu Lekaneis Laaretz." So they, when they heard the decree, they said, "Woe to us! We'll never get into the land." Right? He says it wasn't just that they didn't think it would be real. Once they knew that sin could prevent them from going into Israel, they were worried that 40 years later it would just happen again, and then the next generation wouldn't go in. So vim kanin ledavar sof, and then it'll never end, right? Every time you're ready to go in, someone will mess up. Amar lam HaKadosh Baruch Hu bevadai la'achar mem shana tavo el haaretz. So God had to tell them there is an end, right? It wasn't just generic. It was God had to tell it, right? Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Ramban are saying either people were afraid they'd never go in, right? General fear, or it wasn't real to them. The Dabz Kanim takes it farther. No. It wasn't that they didn't believe God. They do believe God. But once they know that sin can prevent them from going in, they need to be told, but it won't keep you out indefinitely. There will be, and you will go in. The second generation, no matter what happens, will go in. And that's indeed what we end up seeing, that even though the second generation also complains and also makes mistakes, God forgives those sins and lets them go in anyways. All of those positions, though, focus on a positive, right? That this is coming at some level to comfort the Jews. The Chizkuni, though, takes it in the exact opposite direction, to say, no, this is to make it worse. Right? This is worse. Namely, he is telling them they're going to go into Israel, but the message was not primarily for the second generation, it was for the first generation, to tell them, by the way, you know how much you lost out on because you don't get to go into Israel? Right? It's not just you're not going to Israel. There's all these opportunities. Let me rub it in. Let me tell you what you lost. And that's where the Chizkuni takes it. In 5, he says, "El eretz moshavotechem, aval bamidbar lo takrivu." But you can't bring these carbon out here, ki atem bimezid, because you willfully violated God's word. V'ein karban kapara lemezid. And karbanot cannot atone for intentional sins. So there will be a time when you'll go in, you'll be able to bring karbanot to atone for accidental sins, to make you have a good relationship with God, but here, that's not what happened. You, and it's only when you get to Israel, will you have a good relationship, but right now, you just don't. So that's possibility two, right? Possibility one, with all its variations, were that these laws were coming to comfort the Jews or convince them that there will be an end to this. Possibility two is that it's also rubbing it in and telling and emphasizing to the first generation what they were losing. The third possibility, right? Now, the first two possibilities, though, what they have in common is that they assume that the law isn't new in a sense that this was always going to be the law. God just revealed it at this point, right? I mean, God told the Jewish people about these laws now to either emphasize that they'll make it into Israel or to emphasize what they're losing by not getting to go into Israel. The Svarno takes the third possibility, which is that these laws weren't just told now, but they actually are only commanded because of the Meraglim. Right, that's the third, right, the third possibility. And this is what he said. He said, "Laso reach nicholach." He said, "What is the guiding words in these psukim? Is reach nicholach that God consistently says you can bring karbanot so that you will have a pleasing scent to God, meaning you will be pleasing to God." So the Svarno says, "We'll see it in a second." Says, "You know why? Because until now, you didn't need to bring Carbonot to be pleasing to God. You were pleasing to God. You had a relationship with God. But you blew it. You blew it. You said no to what God gave you. He gave you a land. He offered you a land. And you said, I don't want it. Your relationship is marred. Now God had to tell them, you know what? Here's a tool that you can use to recreate that relationship with me. Because you really, right? There's something missing now. And that's what this runner writes. He said, "Lasot reich nichoach, v'ikriv ha-makriv." To make this fine sent to God, and the sacrifice, right, the person bringing the karban will bring it. He said, "Hinei ada egel," or until the egel, "haya karban reich nichoach bezulat mincha nisachem." He said, until now, until the egel, really, you could have brought a karban, and it would have been pleasing to God without a mincha, without a libation. Kenyan behevel v'noach v'avraham, right? Noach, Avram, have all the early karbanot. You brought a karban and God liked it. You didn't have all these rules that with a karban you have to bring your wine and oil and flour, right? You had to make a whole production. Kenyan v'yishlach et na'arei b'nei Yisrael v'ayilu olot u'zvachim, zvachim, z'reveiz b'chu zvachim shlamim la'ashem parim. Or at Har Sinai, when they just brought karbanot. Lo zulatza, that was it. U'vechet am be'egel. After the Egel, the Torah introduces that when you bring the daily karban, you need to bring nisachim with it. You need to make that a production. She karban sibur. And once the meraglim, hitzrich minchan nisachim lachshir gan karban yachid. Every single karban you bring is a whole production now, because he said early times you brought a karban, God liked it because you had a good relationship. You messed up once with the Egel, so now when the community brings a carbon, I need a production. I need to see that you really care. So it's not just enough to bring a carbon, you've got to bring all these accoutrements. You mess up again, any carbon you bring, private, public, doesn't matter, you've got to bring all the pomp and circumstance of a carbon. I mean, each time you sin, each time our relationship is, the more distance is put into our relationship, you've got to go out of your way and prove that you really want to build this relationship in order for it to be successful. So that's the first mitzvah, right? The first mitzvah of these karbanot, right? Rashi, Ramban, Ibn Ezra take in different variations simply as a promise, as comfort that they'll go into the land. Chizkuni says it also rubs in to the first generation what they lost. And the Svarno says it's not just about finding out about the mitzvah, it actually reflects a change in their relationship, that before their relationship was strong enough, they didn't need all these libations for God to enjoy their karbanot, to enjoy their gift. Now, you know, it's been really bad, right? It's always, right, you want to get a present to make up after a fight, the worse the fight, right? The more effort you have to put in to making up for it. So each time, he said, right, we did the Egel, bigger present. You did Meraglim, bigger present, right? Each time you've got to show that you care more. So that's mitzvah one. The second mitzvah is, as I said, is challah. So this is picks up in Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayidaber Adonai Moshe le'emor. Daber al b'nei Yisrael v'amart aleihem bivoachem el haaretz asher ani mevi etchem shama. When I bring you into the land, vaya b'chalchem milechem haaretz tarimu truma l'Adonai. When you eat of the bread of the land, you will give truma, you'll give a donation. What is that donation? Reishit arisotechem chala tarimu truma k'trumat gard ken tarimota. The first of your flour and your dough will go to, right, will be donated. Me reishit arisotechem titnu l'Adonai truma l'dorotechem. From the first of your flour, of your kneading, you will give a portion to Hashem for your generation. So the second mitzvah is chala. Now this one, in an even more striking way, right, drives, right, it makes sense why this is here, because it's not just that they rebelled against the land. They didn't want the land. They didn't say it was tova, right? What is the message of challah or truma or bikurim or any of those first gifts? It is you're thanking God and saying, hey, this land is great, I really appreciate it. So as a remedy to the sin of the meraglim, God tells the Jewish people, not only are you going to get into the land, but when you get to the land, here's an antidote to the sin of the meraglim. Instead of complaining they didn't give you a good land, or, if you remember just a few weeks ago, complaining that you don't like the food I give you, right? Which is what set this all off, that you didn't like the man. When you get to Israel, it's going to be good, and you're going to get food, and it's really from me. It's not from heaven anymore, it's from the land. I want you to appreciate the land, and I want you to appreciate that your food comes from me. Right? So as a tikkun, right, as a way of fixing the sin of the Meraglim, where they didn't appreciate the land, and the original complaint, they didn't want the food from God. God says, you're going to get to the land, and I want you to bring challah. I want you to thank God for what you have, for the food, and for the land. And how are you going to do that? By giving a gift, taking the first of your produce, the first of your challah, right, of your kneading, and giving it to the kohen. And you see, sort of in a very, right, striking way, why that mitzvah would be here. That's what I would have said is the sort of simple understanding. The Svarno, though, following his theory that the mitzvot here aren't just comfort, but they are they're necessary. He frames it a bit more harshly, and this is the last line of the first page. He said, "Chala tarimu truma acharchein maraglim hitzrich gam achalam mani hu reuyim shetachol bracha bevateihem." It's not just to fix the emotional problem you have; it's that I need you to bring this because until now I was ready to bless you no matter what, but now you've sinned so badly. If you want to be blessed, you need to do something. I need you to initiate. So that's mitzvah two, right? So mitzvah one, the karbanot, again, either it's there to comfort them, they'll make it into the land, rub in what they're losing, or for the svarno, it only became necessary to have all these accoutrements on the karbanot because the relationship was marred. Mitzvah two, challah. So the svarno, again, following his position, says the reason you need challah is because until now, your relationship was good enough with God that he was willing to bless you. Even if you, even without a gift to him or to his kohanim. Now the relationship is such that if you want bracha, you need to contribute more. I would have just said simply, this is the tikkun, right? The way of ensuring that they don't, that the people learn to appreciate the land and appreciate food from God is to give them a mitzvah that forces them to say, thank you for giving me the land. Thank you for giving me food. Because when people do things, right? This is the chinuch's theory of life, right? Acharei ha'pulot nimshachot ha'levavot. After what you do, right? Your actions affect the way you feel. So God says, I'm not just going to tell you, appreciate me. I'm going to give you a mitzvah that will make you appreciate me and learn from your mistakes. So that is mitzvah two. Mitzvah three is in Chaf Bet. So the third mitzvah that we get is the mitzvah of the karban for communal idol worship. If the entire, or the way Chazal understand it, is that if the entire nation worships Avodah Zarah, there's a special karban, a special sacrifice that you can bring to atone for it. So that's in Pasuk Chabed. V'chi tishgu v'lo ta'asud kol mitzvot ha'il asher diber Adonai el Moshe. If you don't do all the mitzvot. So again, Chazal understand this as Avodah Zarah. The Ramban says that at the level of Pshat, he thinks it means not just when the whole nation worships Avodah Zarah, but a case where the whole nation literally doesn't know the Torah at all. Right? They just violate the whole Torah. And kol asher tziva Adonai aleichem b'yad Moshe minayom asher tziva Adonai v'halo daratechem, and you don't listen to anything God has ever told you. And if even the eyes of the congregation, which Chazal understand, even the Sanhedrin, even the leaders, will make a mistake, so then there'll be a special sacrifice that you bring. And the Kohen will bring a korban, will bring a sacrifice to forgive the sin, atone for the sin of the Jewish people. And it will be forgiven to the whole Jewish people. because they only sinned accidentally. Now, once we already talk about the national sin, so then there's a few psukim of the individual sin as well. But why? Right, why would this mitzvah be here? A mitzvah of what happens when the nation worships avodah zarah or commits or forgets the whole Torah, right? So why would that be here?
So that the same thing doesn't happen again.
Right. So one possibility is, so there's a solution in the future, right? You know, you've all messed up this time. If you mess up again, right? I mean, God's telling them, don't worry. I know that you might mess up, but I have a solution for you. That if you all mess up, I'm putting a mechanism in place that will ensure that you can be forgiven. Right? Just like at some level, I'm forgiving you now. Right? That's the positive way of looking at it. Then there's the negative way of looking at it, which is, if a whole nation sins by accident, you'll be forgiven. But you didn't sin by accident. You sinned on purpose, and that's why I'm not forgiving you. That's why you're all going to die in this desert. Right? The Rav Sadia Gaon, it took me a long time to find this piece in Rav Sadia Gaon, but Rav Sadia Gaon, in a long piece, it was found in the Geniza, so it's published at the end of Rav Sadia Gaon. He asked the question in the Ma'apilim. He said, why wasn't it an act of tshuva, right, of repentance, when the Jews said, let's go to Israel, let's fight? So he picks up on the fact of one word, that when they talk to Moshe, they say that it was a... it was a chet, right? They say that we, right, chatanu. Now, chet usually means an accidental sin. And he said the fundamental problem was that they didn't own up to it. Is that they, after God said, you're all going to die, they didn't want to face the consequences, so they pretended it was all a mistake, right? It was an accidental sin. We didn't rebel against God. We just didn't realize what we were doing. And therefore, we can just fix it. So God tells them, no, you can't just fix it, because if you won't even admit that this was intentional rebellion, you're going to pretend this was just an accidental sin, you don't realize how much you hurt the relationship, then you can't fix it. So this karban is there for one of two reasons. Either positively, it's telling the Jews, don't worry, God does forgive, and that's why in the end of the day, he's forgiving you enough to not kill you, and he's allowing the second generation to go in. And in the future, even if you mess up, there's a way of getting out of it. Or it's a musr to them, which is, look, God's willing to forgive an entire nation if you admit your mistake and you realize what you did wrong and it was by accident. But you willingly rebelled against God and you're pretending it was an accident, but it wasn't an accident. That's why I can't forgive you. Or I can go either way here. So if you look here in number 3, the Ramban, right, takes this up. It says, Katav Ramban. ולפי משמעות פשט הפסוק שאומר ולא תעשו את כל מצוות ולא אמר אחת מכל המצוות כמו שאמר פרשת ויקרא. So the simple understanding of this mitzvah is not that the Jews sin on one sin. It says kol mitzvot. It means someone who doesn't keep any of the mitzvot. What's the case? Vikra. It's talking about someone who rebels against the whole Torah by accident. How does that happen? Kagon, by an individual, by an individual could happen with a person, a child who was captured and raised in a right non-Jewish culture. Now we use that colloquially, right? Tinok Shenishba, people who grew up not right Shomer Torah mitzvos, but what it really means is someone who is literally captured and doesn't know he's Jewish. And there's also a national sin. When would a nation think that the Torah would make that mistake if they think the Torah has been superseded, that the Torah doesn't apply anymore? Right, that it's not eternal. They forgot the Torah. That's why Chazal come to the notion that this is worshipping avodah zarah, the chashiv kechofer b'chol haTorah kula, which is like denying the whole Torah. Uva'atazu ha'parasha la'ashlim b'torat kohanim din shkagat avodah zarah ki sefer zeh me'ashlim din ha'kramanot. It should have been in Vayikra, v'nechteva b'zeh ha'makom. Why is it here? Shehim maru dvar Hashem v'amar netna rosh v'nashuva mitzrayma b'lo Torah u'mitzvot v'chein lasam chalikan. Because when they said they wanted to go back to Egypt, and this is something we've developed, going back to Egypt wasn't just saying, we want to go back to Egypt. It means let's turn back the clock. Let's give up on God. Let's give up on the mitzvot. Right? The reason this is here is to highlight what you did by saying you want to go back to Egypt was the equivalent of saying I want to worship Avodah Zarah. Because what you're saying is I don't want God. I don't want his mitzvot. I don't want his land. I don't want this life. You want to turn back everything. It's a nation who's given up on Kol HaTorah Kula. You want to know what that is? That's this. This is Mussar to them, right? You did this, and not by accident. It was on purpose, right? But what you did was what's being described here. And the Svarno, going back to 6, has a fascinatingly, slightly different approach. And he says it wasn't just to them. It was for the future. Because it says like this. V'kitishgu, he said, Kfar hitbayer b'kabbalah shibgad avodah zarah katav medaber. The Talmudic understanding is that this is talking about avodah zarah, about idolatry. V'zeh kimachar shenigzar aleihem lapil zaram b'goyim. Once God said that they're going to be punished, part of that includes galut, that they'll go to the land, but that may end temporarily. Lo yanim nashi yishgu b'avodah zarah b'shuvam la'artzam. Once the Jews have sinned so much that there's a possibility of galut, then that means there's a possibility that one day they'll be led out of the land and they'll learn Avodah Zarah and they might even come back to Israel, but they still might be worshippers of Avodah Zarah. Because once galut's in the system, your national future is not secure. And therefore, the Svarno says this isn't just Mussar directed at them, it's emphasizing to them the consequences of their actions. Is that they've set in motion a process that may lead not just them to having sinned, but future generations sinning and requiring an ability to get forgiveness even for national Avodah Zarah. So that's the first three mitzvot, right? So, right, and you see, right, as we go through, each of the mitzvot here seems to, right, build in a real way, in different ways, on it. So again, the first mitzvah is either positive to assure them they're going to the land, or as a negative to rub in that they're going to the land, but only the second generation is going to the land, but not the first one, or to at least tell them there will be there will be an end to this even if they sin. The second one, or as the Svarno says, it was necessary because now their relationship was marred, and therefore God's emphasizing that now you need to do different things. Chala is either there to emphasize you're going to the land, or it's there to provide a solution to their lack of recognition of God and their thanks for God. And therefore, this requires them to say, thank you for the food you give us, and thank you for the land, and fix the complaints of the man and the land. Or, as the Svarno, now that they've sinned, they need to show how much they care about God for him to bless them again. And then the third mitzvah, the possibility that there's a karban for national sin, is either emphasizing this is what you did, right? This wasn't mere sin. This was idolatry. This was an abandoning of the Torah. Or as Rav Sajagon says, it's emphasizing as Mussar to them, God is willing to forgive the nation when they sin by accident, but don't pretend your sin was an accident. Or three, as the Svarno takes it, it's telling the Jews, realize that once you've sinned and you've set in motion the problems of Galut, you're not the last generation that's going to sin. You've just created problems. In the future, this may happen again. So that's three, right? Four. Right? There are a lot of sort of mini mitzvot, but each of them connects. So the fourth thing, if we skip down, is, and this is the last one we'll do, and then we'll do tzitzit next week as a separate one, because that's sort of the culmination of it, is a very short story in Pasuk Lamed Bet. Pasuk Lamed Bet. Vayihyu v'nei Yisrael b'midbar v'yimtzu ish mekoshei sheitzim b'yom haShabbat. Right in the middle of this story, we get another story, which is that it was on Shabbos that there was a person cutting down wood on Shabbos. Vayakrivu oto amotzim oto mekoshei sheitzim o'moshe v'el aron v'el kol ha'idah. And the people who found him bring him to Moshe and to the nation. And they put him in jail because they don't know what to do with him, right? A holding cell, so they need to figure out how to punish him. And God says, the death penalty. Stone him outside the camp. So they take him out and they stone him. So what happens? Why is this here? So one possibility is that it emphasizes that the difference between accidental and intentional sins. And the truth is, if you look at a pasuk, just one pasuk before, right after the whole discussion of karbanot for accidental idolatry, there's one pasuk. There's two pasukim of if someone willingly worships avodah zarah, then he gets killed. Right, there is no karban for him. So this is what the Tur Ha'aruch had said, right, based on the Ibn Ezra, that the reason these two laws come here is to emphasize the difference between accidental sin that there's forgiveness for and intentional sin that there's punishment for. And it gives you a story to say, by the way, look, it actually happens. Just like the Jews as a nation, when you sinned intentionally, you got punished. Hey, here's an individual that got punished. And that's sort of the cynical one here. But it's also possible that this is a positive story. How could this be a positive story? So I'll say it outside, but I gave it to you here from Rabbanit Sharon in English, but I don't know how she pronounces her name. She notes the following. She says, this story is very, in many ways, similar to the story that we had in Vayikra of the blasphemer, right? There was a person there who blasphemed God. They didn't know how to punish him, so they bring him and they put him in jail, and then God says he gets the death penalty and they punish him. Right? And she says they're very similar. Both stories describe, and this is in 7, they both describe the sin of an individual, the name of the perpetrator isn't mentioned, the sinner is placed in detention because it's not clear what should be done with him, the law requires clarification, the punishment is the same in both cases, right? They're stoned by the entire congregation. The text describes the execution of the sentence, and both narratives are located in the midst of a group of mitzvot, right? These stories are very, very similar. But on the other hand, she notes that there are 6 important differences. Right? One is that while neither perpetrator is mentioned by name, the blasphemer is identified as the son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian man and his mother's name was Shlomit Bat Ivri, but the Mekoshe Sheitzim is totally anonymous. Right? He has no identity. He's just the sinner. Right? We have no idea who he is. 2 is the sin of the blasphemer is clear. Right, it goes through. He got into a fight, and once he was in a fight, in the middle of the fight, he cursed. Right, he committed blasphemy. Here you get 6 words. There was a guy who gathered wood. No one even knows what he did. Right, he did something. We don't know if he cut the wood. We don't know. Right, there's different things he could have done on Shabbos. Right, cutting wood is a violation of Shabbos. Gathering wood is a violation of Shabbos. Right. Pruning, they're all different ways he could have violated. We don't even know. He did something with wood on Shabbos, but it's left very vague. Now, in the blasphemer, in the case of the Mikalel, the protagonist of the story, so to speak, or not protagonist, but the anti-hero of the story, is the Mikalel himself. It constantly talks. He got into a fight. He got into a fight. He blasphemed. He cursed. Here, there's actually no action, right? The Mekoshe Sheitzim is never described as doing anything. The verbs are all the Jewish people, right? If you look at it again, Vayimtzu ish Mekoshe Sheitzim b'yom haShabbat. They found someone who was violating Shabbos. Vayakrivu oto hamotzim oto. The ones who found him brought him, right? The verb is are all about not him, but about the people who found him. The 4th thing is that the Mikalel was brought to Moshe alone, while here the Mekoshesh is brought in front of the entire nation. By the Mikalel, when it says that the reason they didn't know what to do with him, it says that they were waiting for it to be explained by God. It doesn't focus on anybody. It wasn't not explained to Moshe, just as it wasn't explained, which sounds like to the people, like they don't know the halach as a nation. And the last thing is that the Mikalel, which we saw when we looked at the story, had a whole set of laws after it. Right? Once we finish that story, it says, by the way, don't blaspheme, don't fight, right? All those things, which made sense. I mean, there was laws that came in light of that story. This story, there are no related laws. The story is just dropped down. The only law we discover is that he gets stoned, but that's it, right? There's nothing about keeping Shabbos. There's nothing. It's just he gets killed, and that's it. We don't. There's no follow-up. There's no national education. So what Rabbi Nit Rimon suggests is that, right, even if the first three stories, or four laws, rather, are a bit cynical here, right, in certain ways, there's one question hanging over our heads when we get into this story, which is, after the Jews find out that they're going to die and they're not going to make it into Israel, do they give up? Or do they just give up? Do they say, forget it, we're not going into Israel, we're not going to keep the Torah, we're done. Do we? Right? If you don't want us, we don't want you. And you would expect that they would, right? This was the people who were so petrified that they just, a minute ago, were willing to say, Nina Rosh, Menashe Mitzrayim, but we're just going to give up, we're going to go back to Mitzrayim, we're going to give it all up. But she points out that's not what happens. Because what's this story tell you? That there was a person who violated Shabbos, and the whole nation springs to action. And they say, you can't violate Shabbos! You can't violate what God said! And they find him, and they bring him to court, and they tell Moshe, ask God what to do with him. And she said, you know why this story is here? To tell you that despite all of it, even if all these laws before were cynical, and we're telling the Jews, you know what, your children will make it into Israel, but you won't. And you sinned on purpose, and therefore you're not going to be forgiven. You would expect the Jews at that point to give up. And say, well, if we have no hope and God isn't going to forgive us, then forget it. We're not going to go in. Then we're not going to be committed to the Torah. So the Torah tells you, but that's not how it happened. Because despite what you would expect, those people who rebelled, who there's no forgiveness for, who are not going to make it into Israel, and they're going to have to wait for the next generation, at some level they learned their lesson. At some level they said, okay, we may be in for the long haul. We may never get out of this desert. But while we're here, we've learned the lesson, and we're going to keep what God said. And if someone violates it, if someone rebels, then we're going to step in. Because we may die in this desert, but if we're going to die in this desert, at least we're going to salvage our relationship with God during that period. We're not going to give up. And that's what she writes. She said, this seems the story of the gatherer is not really about the sin of an individual. Rather, it's the story about the Israelites. It is they who are in the wilderness. It is they who find a man transgressing Shabbat. It is they who bring him before the entire congregation, not just before Moshe, waiting to clarify what sort of death sentence applies. And it is they who carry out the sentence. Rav Sham Shmuel Hirsch explains the opening words, when the Israelites were in the wilderness, as well as the entire formulation of this story, in comparison to the story of the blasphemer, all this shows that the text is placing a strong emphasis here on the initiative of the people, the actions of the Israelites and their involvement for the sake of the Torah. What do we learn about the Israelite congregation from this story? So the Midrash offers the following insight. They found a man gathering sticks. This tells us that Moshe had appointed watchmen, and they found him gathering. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him. Why is this repeated? Is it not already written that they found a man? What new information is added by the words, those who found him brought him? This tells us that they had warned him to desist from his forbidden labor. Right? The Midrash imagines that Moshe had set up religious watchmen. And that we know, to put someone to death in halacha, you need to warn them. Which means that the Jews weren't just bringing him. They were actively setting up and saying, we will still have a religious society. From the verses describing the discovery of this man, the sages deduce that it's not by chance they found him. They are watchmen, and these watchmen not only catch the transgressor, but also try to prevent him from sinning and warn him. The message, in short, is that there is an attempt on the part of Moshe and the nation to prevent sin. Thus, Parshat Shlach describes spiritual progress. The Jewish nation, described in the story of the spies as a congregation of sinners and violators of God's word, is revealed in the narrative of the stick gatherer as a community seeking to observe and fulfill God's word. From this congregation, it is important that every individual behaves in accordance with God's commandments. So it seems at, you know, first glance to be sort of an unrelated series of laws about Karbanot and Challah and an unrelated story of someone violating Avodah Zarah, seem to be actually God's way of responding and saying, don't worry, you will go into Israel. You did make a mistake. I'm not denying that. I'm emphasizing you made a mistake. I'm telling you what your mistake was. It's a combination of educating them through law, giving them hope through law by telling them you will make it to the next stage. And when you get there, I have suggestions for you so you don't fall into the same traps. I want you to bring challah. I want you to learn to appreciate me. I want you to learn to educate, to live in the land. It gives solutions when future mistakes come up, and God tells them, look, you may have made mistakes. This may lead to even more mistakes down the line, but I'm going to give you solutions because I don't want there not to be a solution. The way the Svarno says it is, it may be that your relationship is marred, but that doesn't mean God is going to leave it marred. He gives you more work and says, okay, it's going to be harder for you to build a relationship with me, but here's how you do it. And then the question that hangs over the story is, does it work? Right? Does this attempt to convince the people there is hope and that all is not lost, and even if you're being punished, God does forgive, does that make an impression on the people? Do they actually commit? And what Rabbanit Rimon says is, yeah, that's the story of the Mikoshesh, is that instead of giving up, the Jews take to heart God's message and say, okay, we may be stuck here, we may not make it into the next land, but our children will, and we still have a relationship with God, and we have a lot of work to do. And when they see somebody sinning, they say, no, don't give up. Don't just say, we've sinned once, and now it's all done, it's all gone. We will make sure that the society we maintain the next 40 years, it may not be ideal, but we're not going to give up entirely. And therefore, the Mikoshesh, ironically, gives a little bit of hope because it shows a Jewish people who, despite it all, despite the punishment, and despite, at some level, the lack of hope, because they know there's no end for them, but you see a nation who are willing to make the best of the circumstances for the time being, who are willing to say to God, we made a mistake, and therefore, in the next 40 years, we won't rebel. We will live a life with you in this desert, even if we'll never get out of it. And that gives, so that you, it gives you a little bit of hope that, right, they are progressing, they are developing, and the cynics and the rebels that you see at the beginning of the story, though they will never get out of it, don't die rebels, don't die in tension with God, but actually live their life out in the Midbar to some extent with a renewed commitment to God that they are inspired to from the mitzvot that he gives them. So we'll stop there, and we'll continue with tzitzit, which is the last of the mitzvot in this unit.